You're listening to Civic Conversations, a podcast collaboration between the League of Women Voters, Bloomington Monroe County, and WFHB. I'm Jim Allison, your host, and Becky Hale is our producer. We're pleased to say you can find Civic Conversations every month on WFHB at 91.3 and 98.1 FM Bloomington, 100.7 Nashville, and 2106.3 Ellettsville. And you can also find the podcast at the League website, whose address is www.lwv-bmc.org. This month, we're very pleased to welcome the director of IU's Arnholt Investigative Center, Kathleen Johnston, who is a 30-year veteran of investigative journalism. She's a media school professor of practice, and she's the center's founding director. She's also an IU alumna. And she's worked at many, many national and local news organizations, from the Indianapolis News to CBS, the Birmingham Post Herald to CNN. And she has many regional and national honors, including Emmy, Peabody, and Murrow Awards. And in 2017, she received the Media School's Distinguished Alumna Award. Welcome to you.
Well, thank you for having me, Jim.
Let's start off by having you tell us something about the Arnold Investigative Center. Just how did it come to be, and just how does it seek to promote journalism?
Sure. Several years ago, Michael Arnold, a 1967 alum, met with some people at the journalism school unit and talked about wanting to finance with a founding endowment of $6 million an investigative reporting center. And out of that came the Arnold Center for Investigative Journalism. We've been in operation now for 6 years. We are a working newsroom, and our students, primarily undergrads, although we have a graduate component, but our undergrads work in teams with professional media. Companies like Associated Press and Indy Star and USA Today, Gray TV, among others, on state and national investigative stories. We pay our students. We're trying to, and they do it all. From crunching data to finding documents to filing freedom of information request to doing interviews out in the field and on phone. And we're trying to simulate what it's like to be an investigative journalist.
So they really do it all. That's great.
They do it all.
Let's talk about a really big question. Maybe it's too big. What is the responsibility of the press in the politics of a democracy? In your opinion, what is its proper role there?
Well, I'm not sure about the politics per se, because everybody has a different definition of what politics is, right? But I'm really finding it more and more. That the press is essential, right, to our democracy. Without a free press, we don't have a free democracy, as far as I'm concerned. There's a reason our founding fathers made it the First Amendment, right? So that they highlighted freedom of speech and freedom of assembly and freedom of the right to choose a religion. And I think, it's a cornerstone of democracy. We really are what they call the fourth estate. It's our job, I think, to be the eyes and ears of our government, whether it's local, state, or national. And I tell the students all the time, I'm also a professor of practice, as you mentioned, and I tell the students all the time, it's not our job, to elect or indict or prosecute. We got to trust our readers and our viewers to do that with the information we share with them. But it is our job to collect the facts as we can find them and present the truth as it's known through these facts. We don't necessarily believe in alternate facts. If the sky is blue, the sky is blue. If it's raining, it's raining. You can't tell me it's not raining. That just doesn't work that way. A fact is a fact, and we try to follow that and present the best information as possible. With investigative journalism, what makes investigative journalism, I think, different from daily newspapering and television and multimedia news organizations is that we hold someone or something accountable for the information we find. We lay it proverbial at someone's feet.
It's not just entertainment, that's for sure.
No, it's not.
Okay, almost every day it seems we hear about the death of yet another print newspaper. And in fact, just since 2005, over 3,200 of those papers have just vanished, which is an outstanding rate of more than two per week. And just this past year, another 130 have shut their doors. How are such losses likely to impact our democracy? Must have some impact.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one less voice is one less voice, right? It's one less pillar of democracy standing up for it, as far as I'm concerned. Look, I mean, this is a changing business. It's been changing for over, since I really got into it, it's been changing. When I graduated from college, I am an Indiana University graduate. I couldn't get a job. I was a diehard newspaper reporter. That's all I wanted to do since I was in grade school, and I did everything you should have. I had an internship. I was a stringer for the New York Times and the like. I worked for the student newspaper, the Indiana Daily Student. I did everything you're supposed to do, and I graduated. And I couldn't get a job, and I couldn't get a job for almost a year, and that's because it was the year all the afternoon papers were dying. And yet, I found a way to have that career. But I also, after spending half my career in newspapers, I pivoted to television, and became what I called an accidental television journalist, but one nonetheless. And first in local TV and NBC in Indianapolis, and then at CNN for many years, and following CBS. But I think what we're seeing is we are seeing a new shift. Legacy newspapers and television are going away. There'll always be a few of them, but I think particularly as TV, you're seeing this happening very quickly right now. And I think this multimedia not-for-profit model is going to be, probably predominant for a long time. That's just my opinion. And I hope so, because I think the ProPublicas, the Arnold Centers, the Texas Tribunes, the Limestone Post. I think those are organizations that are trying to pick up the slack from where we lost these newspapers. But there's no doubt that it's a sad for those of us who love newspapers, right? And television, for that matter. It's no doubt that it's a loss. But we have to go with the times. Just as our parents went from radio to television, we're going from television to streaming. And you ask anybody, that's how they get their news. I have to admit, I get most of my news that way. I don't turn on the television in the morning. I look at my phone. And I think we have to adapt to those models. You can still do good journalism. You just got to find a way to present it, in a form
Boy,
for delivery, I think is what.
Well, more and more we see the press engaging with the public, not in print, but digitally,
Right.
and often laden with disinformation or misinformation. Is this good? Is it bad? Is it inevitable? What do you think?
Well, I think it's inevitable. I mean, it's happening, right? It's hard. I'm an old investigative journalist. I rarely put anything in social media, although I have accounts of all of those, but I recognize this is where the news is going, and I think we have to adapt to that. I think disinformation is a probably one of the biggest problems we have in delivering news these days. Not everybody can be a journalist. I don't you can't just say I'm a journalist, and I guess they can say it, but it doesn't necessarily make them so, at journalism as you and I know it, in terms of delivering the facts and not trying to present a certain point of view. But I think it's inevitable. Whether it's good or bad, I think time will tell. Is basically, I mean, some of it is not good. I mean, we know that, right? We know it's more difficult to discern what's a fake, AI published photo versus what is an accurate photo. It's the manipulation is true, but I think that's why they need more journalists. And I don't think it's a reason for have less. I think it's a reason we need more.
Oh, yeah, I agree. Well, recently, your Arnold Center hosted a very interesting guest, a Nobel Peace Prize winner named Maria Ressa. And she is a Philippine journalist famous for her 2022 book, How to Stand Up to a Dictator. And my question for you is, did she have any useful advice for Americans?
Yeah, I think she did. You know, Maria Ressa is just a fascinating individual. We hold the Arnold Center hosts an annual symposium every February, and I hope your listeners, you know, tune in next February and come to the media school for our event. We're hoping to have a we have a day long investigative symposium, which we offer free to the public and students especially, because we want investigative journalism to be accessible to all. And Maria Ressa worked with me and Sarah Seidner, who's on our board and is an anchor at CNN. We all worked at CNN together. But Maria and Sarah especially worked together at the time for quite a long time on the international, on CNN International. And, you know, we had tried for a couple of years to get her, so we were very lucky to have her. She's a true inspiration. I mean, this is someone who literally has put her life on the line for her journalism in her native country. She's a dual citizen, you know, but what she's done in standing up to a dictator is just amazing. She's about 5'2". And I think the main message she gave, sort of piggybacks on your last question, is that, you know, her warning is social media is being manipulated by, you know, dictators and authoritarian governments, and we need to be vigilant. We need to
Yeah,
be vigilant. And I think
right.
that's really her main message. And she said, you know, and she can't be the only one being vigilant, you know. I mean, it has to be everybody standing up to the no. We can't just, you know, it's not a good thing just to listen to those that agree with us. It's a good thing to have other opinions. That used to be, we used to like to hear other opinions, you know. We might not agree with them, but we used to like that. But we seem to go a different way these days.
Yeah, right. Well, President Trump in the last 170 days or so has banned AP, that is the Associated Press, from the White House briefing room, and he's allowed only his very favored journalists inside. And my question is, what do you think is the likely impact on the news we hear from our White House? And also, what about Brandon Carr, who is the new chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, no less, who has promised, he's actually promised to use his broadcast licensing power to attack dissent? Can you believe it?
No, I well, yes, because we're watching it daily. I mean, there was something today about you know, the president going off on his Truth Social media platform about 60 Minutes because of a couple interviews yesterday, and saying that Brendan Carr needs to go after them, which I disagree. That's not what Brendan Carr's job is. That job is to, you know, foster, you know, broadcast licenses and the like, not to just, you know, go after someone because you don't agree that what they say. And that's, you know, and I think he's particularly upset with 60 Minutes, which I think most people, even if they don't like what 60 Minutes always says, you knows that they're probably the granddaddy standard of investigative journalism here these days in our country. And maybe even around the world. I mean, they're just a outright. I know people that, you know, I worked for CBS, and I know people that worked at 60 Minutes. In fact, Scott Pelley was our opening speaker for the Arnold Center 6 years ago. So I, you know, I it's a slippery slope, and I hope, you know, I hope people know that when they go after your voice, you know, someone you don't like, the next one could be your voice. So, you know, I don't think people should be cheering so hard about, you know, go get them, because you could be next. As you know, I think we saw that. I think history showed us that, you know, during World War II. You know, I mean, and during all these wars, your voice could be next. As to your first question about Associated Press, so I have a lot of opinions on this. First of all, I think the White House correspondents, you know, I don't run the show. But I think everybody should have just stopped going to the White House. You know, that's what I think.
Well, that's
I
what I have
mean,
sounded.
to me, I think, yeah, to me, I think, you know, you would have called this off right. Call the bluff, you know. You don't want them, all of us sit down and we won't go, you
Yeah,
know. I
great.
mean, there's nothing worse than to be have a press conference and no one there, right?
Yeah.
But that's me. I would have told everybody, let's get together. I think there's power in numbers, and make a statement. Look, the federal judge who was appointed by Trump, said you can't restrict the AP. You know, he specifically said, under the First Amendment, if government opens doors to some journalists, be it the Oval Office, the East Room, or elsewhere, it cannot then shut those doors to other journalists because of their viewpoints. The Constitution requires no less. Now, this is a President Trump-appointed judge, a federal judge, and I think he's right. I don't think, you know, just because you don't like what someone says doesn't mean you can, you know, turn them off. You can turn them off. You can walk away. You don't have to listen to them. But in the White House, you know, whether it's the White House or City Hall or whatever, if you grant some journalists access, you got to grant all journalists access. You don't want to, you know, it's your prerogative not to answer their questions. So if the AP wanted to stand and got into that White House briefing and asked a question, it's Mr. Trump's perfect right to ignore everything and ignore them completely, but you can't restrict them from coming. You know, I was really, you know, this is a minor thing. I mean, this is a minor compared to what's happening with AP, but, you know, when I was a newspaper woman working for the Indianapolis News, we were doing a huge series on Lilly Endowment, which, you know, everybody knows Lilly as the group that has bestowed its riches on Indianapolis, helping to remake it into a major league city with a sports initiative. But, you know, not everything they did was, you know, completely in keeping with the Lilly Endowment thing. And we, you know, Lilly Endowment's wishes and or charter. And we did an investigation on him. And when it came time to go to interview the head of Lilly Endowment, the editor, our city editor, picked me and another woman because we were doing the story. And the spokesperson at that time for Lilly Endowment, which, by the way, I love Lilly Endowment. They're a great organization. But the spokesperson at that time said, we don't want Kathleen Johnston to do this interview. And my city editor said exactly what you'd want an editor to say. He said, look, if you don't want her to do the interview, that's your prerogative. But you don't get to tell us who gets to do that interview. She's going to show up at the door. If you don't want to let her in, that's fine. But we're not letting you dictate who interviews it. And let me tell you, the ants, they opened the door, and I had a very pleasant and illuminating interview with the head of the endowment at the time. So I think that's, you know, I think that's the way you should be, you
That's a
know.
perfect example. Yes, I agree. Finally, the demise of the commercial press suggests that it is too weak for us to depend on it any longer for the news and the information that we all require as responsible citizens of a democracy. So, what do you think of the notion that we should treat public service journalism as a public good like clean air, clean water, national defense, as I read recently in the New York Times? And also, do we have any models to emulate?
Well, I don't agree that we're too weak, that the demise, I mean, our numbers have dwindled, right? We're not as many, but I think we have more tools to work with. I think we're just as powerful collectively in terms of the journalism we can do. I mean, there is damn good journalism going on around this country,
There
especially
is, yes,
investigative journalism.
true.
And, you know, I mentioned some of those sites like ProPublica, but even the New York Times and Washington Post, and I like to think the Arnold Center, you know, with some of the investigative stories we're doing with our partners. You know, a couple weeks ago, our students teamed up with Capital Chronicle and did a story on the biggest economic development project in the state. And no one really knew how much money was being thrown at this public money. And our students got a pretty good figure of close to $1 billion. And that story resonated around the State House. And I think that's what journalism does. For me, I think we're going to these newer models, these not-for-profit models. And some, you know, some are, you know, replacing legacy media. And look at in Maine, for instance, you know, most of a good portion of the newspapers are under one umbrella, so they don't have to worry about ads and things like that and let someone else worry about it. But, you know, in order to do this kind of journalism, as we're all finding out, we have to have, you know, benevolent benefactors, so to speak, that really believe in journalism. And I think we need more Michael Arnolds, for instance, and people like him, and the MacArthur Grants and the Press Forward and all these people that are giving money. But I don't necessarily agree that our voices weaken. Are we a public service? I think we've always been a public service. I don't know what the New York Times really means by treating it like air and water. I do think there's a little bit of, the sky is falling sometimes with journalists, we're still able to do our work, it may be in different formats. We may be doing stories on TikTok, for instance, because that's where our student readers are. We may be doing stories, for the local television or just podcasts like this. But I don't think there's any less journalism. I think there's still a lot of journalism. It's just not in the traditional format as we know it. And I think we can all change a little bit and adapt. Like I said, I was a diehard newspaper person, and yet I read my news on the phone,
Okay, if you do it, I guess we can do it too.
I guess. I don't know. Thank
Okay,
you.
well, thank you very much, Kathleen Johnson, for a very thorough account of the current state of journalism in America.
Thank you.
And to our listening audience, thanks for listening to us on Civic Conversations. This is Jim Allison, League of Women Voters, Bloomington, Monroe County. The League is a nonpartisan, grassroots, citizen-led organization that's been fighting since 1920 to improve our government and engage all citizens in the decisions that impact their lives. In May, we'll be welcoming James H. Rudy, Professor of Political Science at IU, Dr. Jeffrey Isaac, who will be talking to us about the impact of extremism on our government.